We left off last week in 1 Kings 19, and we actually got as far as verse 18. I'm going to do a little summarizing to kind of move us forward. At the end of chapter 19, Elijah goes and lays his mantle on Elisha, in keeping with what God had told him to do, to go to Elisha, who was going to become the prophet in Elijah's place. Starting in chapter 20, Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, raises up a massive army and goes to war against King Ahab. A prophet, one of the sons of the prophets, tells King Ahab that he is going to defeat King Ben-Hadad, which in fact happens. The war takes place in the hills, so Ben-Hadad goes back home and decides that it must be because they were in the hills and that Israel's God is good in the hills, so next time we'll go after him in the plains. And so a year later, he raises a big old army and comes after him in the plains again. One of the sons of the prophets comes to King Ahab and says, "You're going to win again because the king of Syria said that this God was only powerful in the mountains and not in the plains, and God wanted to show his superiority everywhere he was." So King Ahab once again goes and defeats the king of Syria. However, at the end of it, you will remember that King Ahab is married to this Jezebel. One of her cousins is this Ben-Hadad, and so since they are relatives, King Ahab doesn't end up killing King Ben-Hadad. After the war, Ben-Hadad comes and pleads mercy from King Ahab, and Ahab takes him up in his chariot and rides back to Israel with this other king. One of the prophets then meets him and says, "You did not destroy who God said to destroy, therefore you will be destroyed." So God is quite serious about this. "I told you to do something, you need to do it" thing. But that doesn't directly affect Jezebel, and so I'm skipping over some of that history real quickly. That takes us to chapter 21. Actually, if you want to see it, the end of verse 20, starting at verse 42, the prophet said to King Ahab, "Thus says the Lord, because you let go out of your hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore your life will go for his life, your people for his people." And the king of Israel went to his house very heavy and displeased and went back to Samaria. So there you have God in his absolute, complete, and utter sovereignty, deciding to destroy certain people. This does fly in the face of the folk out there who want to say that big old loving marshmallow God loves everybody and really wants everybody to come to faith, and that he's, you know, just Mr. Even Steven up there in heaven, wants everybody to get an equal shot and just wants people to come to him. Absolutely not here. And in fact, not only did he say that he wanted this king of Syria destroyed, but then he says that he will equally destroy King Ahab for not destroying the one who God wanted destroyed. So God is very decisive in the things that he wants done, and you pretty much do it his way or his way. Those are pretty much the choices. Chapter 21 begins. "It came to pass after these things that Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel." Remember that place, Jezreel, and remember this vineyard, because Ahab and Jezebel are both going to meet their death in this vineyard, right up against the palace of Ahab, the king of Samaria. "Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, 'Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it's near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard than it. Or, if it seems good to you, I will give you the worth of it in money.' And Naboth said to Ahab, 'The Lord forbid it me that I should give my inheritance or the inheritance of my fathers unto you.'" Now, what you have to understand to know what Naboth is arguing for here is that when the children of Israel first inhabited Canaan and the area of Samaria, God very specifically laid out plots of land for each of the 12 tribes. And those plots of land became theirs in perpetuity. And every 50 years, the time of the restitution of all things, the year of Jubilee, everything went back to the original owners that God had given it to. So if you were going to buy some land from somebody, you would have to figure out how many years until Jubilee and base the price on that. So you want to make your deal right after Jubilee, so you get 49 years into the deal. But if you were to buy something off somebody, a plot of land, a piece of their inheritance, And it was a 2 years until Jubilee, and 2 years it returns to them. So you would figure out the price accordingly. So here's the king saying, let me buy this from you, let me take this from you. And he's saying, this is my father's inheritance. This has been my father's and grandfather's and great-grandfather's. This is my inheritance in this land, so I'm not going to give it up to you, even if you're the king. So verse 4, Ahab went into his house heavy and displeased. Ahab does a lot of heavy and displeased. Have you noticed that? Back there in verse 43, the king of Israel was heavy and displeased. Verse 4, now he's heavy and displeased. Because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him, for he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid down upon his bed, and he turned away his face, and he wouldn't eat anything. And you know his servants had to be coming and saying, eat something, king. Eat, no, I'm heavy and displeased. Verse 5, but Jezebel, his wife, came to him. This is going to mix things up. And said to him, why is your spirit so sad, and why won't you eat any bread? He said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, and I said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it please you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. And he answered and said, I will not give you my vineyard. And Jezebel, his wife, said unto him, do you now govern the kingdom of Israel? In other words, aren't you the king? So let your heart be merry. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. Verse 8, so she wrote letters. Watch how she does this, conniving woman. She wrote letters in Ahab's name. She sealed them with his seal and sent the letters unto the elders and unto the nobles that were in the city dwelling with Naboth. So she sits down and writes letters as if it's from the king, uses the king's seal. She's forging letters for her husband and sending them out to all the nobles and all the powerful people to get them to come to a party she's going to throw on Naboth's behalf. And as she wrote the letters, she wrote, proclaim a fast, and then set Naboth on high among the people. And when everybody's really celebrating Naboth, oh, the great Naboth, look, the king has set you on high. Do this. Set two men, sons of Belial, before him to bear witness against him, saying, you did blaspheme God and the king, and then carry him out, and then stone him so that he'll die. Here's a jolly letter. Belial, by the way, means lying or deception. Belial is actually, in the King James, they capitalized it as if it's a proper name because it came to be one of the names attributed to the devil. But originally it just meant lie or deception, a scoundrel, a liar, and the whole idea of bearing false witness. I mean, you look at the Ten Commandments, it's right in there. You will not bear false witness against your brethren, but it took two witnesses in Israel for anything to be established as true. So she said, get me two liars. Go find me two scoundrels, two sons of Belial, who will come in and lie against him and say that he blasphemed God and the king, and then we'll just kill him. There's a good plan. Verse 11, and the men of his city, even the elders and the nobles, who were the inhabitants of his city, did as Jezebel had sent unto them. That means that all the weasels in the city, the big nobles and the princes and everybody who wanted to keep their standing with the king, got this letter and all went, okay, we get it, it's a lie, we know, but we're going to be killing Naboth as a group. This is good. They did as Jezebel had written to them, and it was sent, written in a letter, saying they proclaimed a fast, and they set Naboth on high among the people. Verse 13, and there came in two men, children of Belial, and sat before him, and the men of Belial witnessed against him, even against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth did blaspheme God and the king. Then they carried him forth out of the city. They stoned him with stones that he was dead. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth is stoned, and he's dead. And it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, okay, now get up, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive, but he is now dead. And it came to pass, when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up and went down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Do you understand what's happening here? This is the king of Israel. He is supposed to be God's representative. And instead, he's lying, cheating, and more importantly, giving in to his wife. This is all in the large context of, you have allowed that woman Jezebel to teach in the churches, having my people worship idols, eat things sacrificed to idols. Here you're getting some sense of what this Jezebel is like. She became more powerful than the king, and he was so spineless and yellow that he wouldn't stand up to his wife, and she ended up ruling Israel and not only introducing all her foreign gods and her idols and her mountaintop altars and her groves to the female gods. She's got this guy completely wrapped around her thumb and is abusing his power to get everything she wants within Israel. So look at verse 17. The word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise, go down to meet Ahab, the king of Israel, which is in Samaria. Behold, he's in the vineyard of Naboth, whether he has gone down to possess it." Now, I had a professor many years ago ask me, "Do you think God, if God exists, do you think that God is a personal God? Or is he impersonal? Is he more on the notion of the unmoved mover, the one who sets everything into motion and then sits back to kind of watch and see how it'll go?" And there are a lot of people who believe that, that God is impersonal, that he is up there, that he does have some amount of power, that he did create everything, but that he doesn't know the future, he doesn't proclaim the future, he doesn't announce how the future is going to go, he certainly doesn't decree the future, but rather he kind of spun this ball and then threw a bunch of people on it and then sat back to watch and see what they were doing because he gave them all an adequate free will and libertarian ability to just decide what it was they were going to do, but that God doesn't necessarily participate in the day-to-day events of life. This king killed a guy and took the vineyard, and God went right to Elijah and said, "Go meet him right now. He's in the vineyard." That's incredibly personal. That's the fine details of life that God is intimately involved in. And my answer to the professor who asked that was, when Moses was over on the backside of the Sinai Desert, and he walked by the burning bush, the bush didn't go, "Hey, you." The bush said, "Moses." It's very, very personal. Moses. When he took Saul, knocked him off his donkey and blinded him, he said, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" That's like double personal. First, he called him by name, and secondly, took it very personal that he was persecuting him. God is an incredibly personal God, who is involved in the minute day-to-day details of life. Which is why next time you're struggling, having trouble, trying to pay your bills, feel sick, whatever's happening in your life, and you're about to ask, "Where is God?" The answer is, he's sitting on his throne doing whatsoever seems good to him. But he's involved, he knows, he's right there, he's aware of it. Providence works. So here you've got him saying, "Ahab, go down and meet him. He's in the vineyard of Naboth." He knew right where he was, what time he was there, and went and got his prophet, said, "Now go talk to him." Verse 19, "And you will speak unto him, and you will say, Thus saith the Lord, Have you killed, and have you also taken possession? And thou shalt speak to him, saying, Thus saith the Lord, In the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall the dogs lick your blood, even yours." How personal is that? Now, that's also a very specific prophecy. That means in the same place when Naboth was stoned, killed, in that same area, your blood is going to run and dogs are going to lick your blood. Now, that's so specific that you can check it. I mean, once he said that, everybody could find out if there was a God in Israel or not. All they had to do was watch King Ahab. And when he died, find out where his body ended up and find out if the blood, in fact, was licked by the dogs. I'll go way ahead for a second and tell you, he's killed in battle out in the plains nowhere near where this vineyard is. But his body is dragged up onto a chariot. He's brought back into the city. And when the men clean the chariot, his blood runs off the chariot and the dogs lay there and lick it. Just like God said. Because God, in fact, declares the future. But look at the minutia that God is declaring. There are people who say, you know, well, God gets involved in the big things. God declares big things, wars, famines, earthquakes, the big things. But God doesn't get involved in the minutia. Jeremiah said the lot is cast into the lap, which basically means you take a couple dice, something random, and throw them into the lap, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. In other words, if you buy a lottery ticket and don't win, that was God's choice. I've often said if the lottery comes to Tennessee, all you have to buy each time there's a new contest, all you have to buy is one ticket. Don't waste your money. Buy one. If God wants you to win, that one will win. You can buy a million, and if God doesn't want you to win, you're going to lose on all million of them, except you'll be out of the $1 million you spent buying tickets. In which case, give me the $1 million, I'll buy one ticket and spend your money more wisely. But look at the minute detail that God was involved in here. Not only will you be killed, but I will see to it that your blood runs and is licked by the same dogs that licked Naboth's blood that you killed. That is so personal. Verse 20 says, "And Ahab said to Elijah, 'Have you found me, O mine enemy?' And he answered and said, 'I have found you because you have sold yourself to work evil in the sight of the Lord. Behold, I will bring evil upon thee and will take away thy posterity and will cut off Ahab from him that pisses against the wall and him that is shut up and left in Israel.'"
What did you just say?
I'm sorry. That's the King James. Okay, do you want to know what it means? What do your translations say? My goodness.
Which verse was that?
This is a King James. I didn't know this was going to cause a fuss. This is 1 Kings 21, verse 21. Every male in Israel, right? Because yes, that's exactly what it means. I'm going to cut off every male heir. But basically what it means by everyone that pisses against a wall is every male, because that's the way men work as opposed to women. It seems confusing. See, people work real hard to clean up the Bible. But the Bible is down here where we live. And remembering that God, in his omniscience, sees everything and knows everything, it's no surprise that God would designate the differences between men and women by one of their most obvious attributes, right? So,
makes sense.
I don't feel the need to clean up the Bible for God. He knows it's in there. So. Verse 22 says, "And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the king of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith you have provoked me to anger, and you have made Israel to sin." Now look there. Every verse here is so important about the character of God. Did God just say, "You have provoked me to anger, so I will cut you off completely, and because you've provoked me to anger, I'm going to bring this evil on you"? Did God just say that? Now, I heard just the other day one of these Word of Faith people, a local guy here, saying and kind of mocking the notion. He said, you know, when people are sick and they say, "Oh, God put this sickness on me because he's trying to humble me," or "God put this," and he just ranted and raved about God doesn't do that. God never brings evil to anybody. God never makes anybody sick. That's the devil, and you have to resist the devil, and it's the devil that put that on you, and you have to, God would never do it. Right here, God just said, "Look, you've provoked me to anger, and I am going to bring a whole lot of evil against you because you provoked me." You can provoke God. You can actually be so anti-God that God will decide, okay, that's enough, especially if you're the king of Israel and supposed to be representative of him among his own people. He said, that's it, I'm going to cut you off now as king, and eventually delivers the whole nation into the bondage of Assyria because they simply will not follow God and do what he says to do. But you have to know that that is the nature and character of God, that he can be provoked. He will reach the point where he says, that's enough, and pour out wrath. That's what the book of Revelation is about. He'll reach the point where he takes his people out and says, okay, that's it, we're done now. Wrath. And a lot of people will be, I think, quite shocked to find out that that God that they have mischaracterized as the big, loving, I love everybody God, to whom there's many pathways, a lot of people are going to be very surprised when God decides to unload. Verse 23, "And of Jezebel also spoke the Lord." When God is naming you by name to say bad things about you, you're in real trouble. "Jezebel also was spoken of by the Lord, saying, 'The dogs shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel.'" The wall where the vineyard was, that was up against the castle, where she killed the man to get the vineyard, God said she will be dead in that same vineyard and dogs will eat her. Now, we probably won't get to it till next time we meet. And you know I won't be here next week. I will be in Lexington. So if you show up here, I won't be. And you're welcome to be here if you'd like, but I won't be. So in 2 weeks, we'll get to it. By the time the dogs get done with her, when they finally go out to bury her, and they say, well, you know, she was the queen, let's go bury her, they find her skull and a couple of bones, licked clean by the dogs, just like God said. That big old loving God, that big old, you dogs will eat your flesh in the streets, right up against that wall where the vineyard was. That's a dear price to pay for wanting a vineyard, isn't it? And him that dies of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat. And him that dies in the field shall the fowls of the air eat. He's talking about his posterity, his sons now, those that do those things that upset Edward. No one got that. He says, all your sons, those out in the field, those in the city, all of them will be killed and eaten by dogs and fowl. None of them are going to have a decent burial. But there was none like unto Ahab, verse 25, there was none like unto Ahab who did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. Look who got credit for it there. Jezebel. This is why this Jezebel thing was so important that it shows up again in the book of Revelation. This Jezebel thing so got under God's skin, if you don't mind that anthropomorphism, that it so bothered God that he actually said in the book of Revelation that at the end of time, one of the things that would still be alive and well and he would be working actively against is this Jezebel doctrine still permeating his church. And he did very abominably in following idols according to all things as did the Amorites whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. Do you get the impression here that God does not like the notion of idol worship? Can anybody think, without spending too much time, of a current idol worship religion? It's not hard, is it? Buddhism, sure, they have plenty of idols. Go over to St. Peter's Basilica, over there by the Vatican, and the statue of St. Peter that stands in the square is marble. The toes of the statue have now been worn down marble by people kissing it. Wow. So many people have kissed the toes of the statue. And that statue, which they're calling Peter, is actually a statue of Jupiter. But it's true. And the toes of it have been kissed away. Now, does God change? No. Does God say that it is an abomination to worship idols here?
Yeah.
There's, of the old school Catholic churches, some of the new modern churches aren't quite so much into their idols, but most Catholic churches still have their statues and their idols up, and you can go and pray to them and light candles to the statue of Mary. And there's just no way to say that that's not idol worship is the point. Anything that is a man-made thing that you bow down, worship to, pray to, venerate is in fact idol worship by definition, and yet it still goes on all over the church. And anything, by extrapolation then, anything that you put before God, anything that takes your attention away from God to the extent, I've seen people who do it for their job or for their wife or for their children or for their own fame and advancement, that God becomes secondary because there's something else that gets in the way of that relationship with God. Anything that gets between you and your relationship with God is by definition an idol. But if you're talking about an image of something that is heavenly or an image of something on earth, whether you're talking about a totem pole or a statue of Mary, anytime that you are worshiping anything other than God, especially something man-made that doesn't talk, doesn't speak, doesn't live, can't think, that is idol worship by definition. And it is still alive and well in the world in multiple different religions, but like you said, still very prominent in Christianity. And yet God doesn't change. It is still an abomination. Yes, ma'am.
Could you explain like what a graven image is?
To be graven just means to be made, handmade.
So would like a...
The word engraved comes from graven.
Jesus, is yeah. that...
You know, yes, by definition, yes, absolutely. The question is, do you worship the thing?
Right.
You know, Because when God said, you shall make no graven images, that you will bow yourself down and worship it. Now, in Israel, they had altars and were burning things to their different gods. They had their groves where they would worship their different gods. And yes, kissing the feet of idols or praying to a statue of Saint Christopher, any of those things are by definition idol worship because you are venerating these things. But just having a picture, I really do believe that God knows the heart. And he knows whether you just happen to have a picture of Jesus because that was some tradition of yours. I'll go further. If you really want to be controversial, and gosh, I've never done that before. The symbol of the cross predates Christianity. It is an ancient sign of Tammuz, especially if it's a cross with a sun behind it. So the cross was never historically, especially among the first century church, the cross was never considered a Christian symbol. You don't see that until the reign of Constantine and the Christianization of Rome, when the cross itself becomes a Christian symbol. And yet there are people who venerate a cross at the front of their church, who bow down in front of that cross, who pray in front of that cross, who kneel at the foot of that cross. Well, you know what? Jesus never designed the cross for worship. He was on it for a few hours, he endured it, and then he got off it. Especially crucifixes. In Catholic churches, there are plenty of crucifixes because they love to keep him on that cross. They don't want him to get off that cross or else they can't keep doing the bloodless sacrifice of the Mass every week. If they get him off that cross, then the redemption is fully accomplished. You don't need the priesthood anymore. So they keep him up there and people pray to that image of Christ up on the cross. That's idol worship. But it doesn't seem like it because it's in a quasi-Christian setting. You understand what I'm saying? But they are still going to an emblem, a symbol, a piece of wood, a chunk of metal, before they'll go to God. God is where you are. You can speak to God now. You can worship God now. You can pray to God and beseech God now, wherever you are. You don't have to be at the foot of a hunk of wood in a cross shape. The cross is not a Christian emblem. The first Christian emblem was a fish.
That's to say. That was a little secret symbol, even right. Just among themselves.
Exactly.
I would think of anything, we would think that, why wouldn't it just be drawn across, you know,
right.
Signify to see who we are.
You know that in Rome, in order to show where the meetings were, that they would draw the fishes in whichever way the fish was pointing, the Christians knew to follow the fishes to find which particular catacomb of the dead they were meeting in. Now there's craving worship. When you're following little secret symbols, knowing that you could be killed, and then you're meeting in catacombs of the dead, which can't possibly smell good, just to get together with other Christians. I mean, that's devotion to a cause. We come in here and complain about, oh, the air conditioning's on too hot. Oh, I'm cool. So he did very abominably in following idols according to all that the Amorites had done, which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. Verse 27, it came to pass when Ahab heard those words that he tore his clothes, he put sackcloth on his flesh, he fasted, he lay in the sackcloth, and he walked softly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah, saying, see how Ahab humbles himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring this evil in his day, but in his son's days will I bring this evil upon his house. In other words, the destruction of all his children. He's going to let Ahab die first now, and then destroy all his children instead of destroying them in front of him. Because God, in fact, likes humility and does not like arrogance and pride and self-sufficiency. So now, chapter 22, which is really where I wanted to get tonight. Oh, gee, I'm almost out of time. So we got to fly. I'll tell you now for a fact. If you go to a free willist church, if you go to a church that believes that God is not, in fact, sovereign over all things and that men have the opportunity to make up their own mind and that they have this absolute freedom whenever they want, you can't read chapter 22 of 1 Kings because chapter 22 of 1 Kings absolutely screams God's sovereignty. So here we are. There continued 3 years without war between Syria and Israel, and it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel, and the king of Israel said unto his servants, know you that Ramoth of Gilead belongs to us, And we are still, and we haven't taken it out of the hand of the king of Syria. And he said unto Jehoshaphat, will you go with me to battle at Ramoth-Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. Now you have to remember that whenever these kings would go into the battles, they would get their prophets to tell them whether they were going to make it. Remember, King Ahab twice had been told that he was going to beat Ben-Hadad, and so both times God gave him the victory. So they said, before we go in and fight against the Syrians to take Ramoth-Gilead, let's ask a prophet and see what he'll tell them. So verse 6, the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said unto them, shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or should I forbear? And they said, go up, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides all these, so that we can inquire of him? Let's make sure we get them all. Jehoshaphat said, oh, there is one more prophet of the Lord besides these. The king said unto Jehoshaphat, there is this one man, Micaiah. I think that's the way it's pronounced. But I can't keep saying that over and over because it's too many vowels. We're going to call him Mick. And because he's Irish, I believe. There is this one, Micaiah, who is the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him, for he does not prophesy good concerning me, but only evil. And Jehoshaphat said, nah, let the king not say so. You have a prophet in your land who says bad things about you? Get out of here. And the king of Israel called an officer and said, hasten hither, Micaiah, the son of Imlah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat each on their thrones, having put on their robes. And they sat in an open place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets prophesied before them. And Zedekiah, the son of Chena'anah, he made horns of iron. And he said, thus saith the Lord, with these horns shall you push at the Syrians until you have consumed them. So this guy even brought visual aids for his prophecy. PowerPoint. I mean, the guy, look, you have horns, you're going to push at the Syrians. And all the prophets prophesied the same thing, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the king's hand. And the messenger that was gone to call Micaiah said unto him, behold now, the words of all the prophets declare good things unto the king with one mouth. Let your word, I pray you, be like the word of them, and speak that which is good. And Micaiah said, as the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, that I will speak. So he came to the king, and the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered and said, go and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king, just like all the other prophets did. Notice the king figured out right away that he was lying. Verse 16, and the king said to him, how many times will I adjure you that you tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? Verse 17, so he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master, so let them return every man to his house in peace. In other words, once you get into the battle, I see you dead, and then I see everybody scattering. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, hey, didn't I tell you that he would only prophesy no good concerning me, but only evil? See, I told you this would happen. Verse 19, and he said, hear thou, therefore, the word of the Lord. Now look at this, starting at verse 19. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven was standing by him on his right hand and on his left. Well, you know from the book of Revelation and from Jesus' own mouth when he talks about the separation of the sheep and the goats, he says that those that are his, that are God's people, will be at his right hand. You know that in the Latin, the word left is the same word for sinister. And on his left hand are those who are the goats who will eventually be driven away from God. So the imagery here is that God is sitting on his throne, but he's called all his host. And he has them on his right and his left, which means he has the good and the bad all in front of him. And he's holding court with them, as it were. And the Lord said, look at verse 20. Who shall persuade Ahab so that he will go up and die at Ramoth-Gilead? And one sat on this manor, and another sat on that manor, and there came forth a spirit which stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. Do you understand what's going on here? Micaiah says to the king, I saw God stand before the hosts of heaven, and they discussed how to kill you. And look at what he used as the methodology, verse 22. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith, or how will you persuade him? And the spirit said, I will go forth and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, God said, you shall persuade him and you shall prevail also. Go forth now and do it. God just conspired with an evil, lying spirit to go lie in the mouth of all the prophets of Israel in order to kill Ahab. How do you make that work with any theology that says anything other than God is absolutely sovereign? You have to fall back on God's sovereignty, or you can't read that passage for what it really says. Because God sovereignly right there just decided to bring evil on a man and use lying spirits to do it in the mouth of his own prophets. That is a phenomenally sovereign God. Yes?
Two questions.
Oh, I have lots of questions. If you narrowed it down to two, we're good. Go.
In James, where it says, let no man say when he's tempted.
I'm tempted of the Lord.
That I'm tempted of the
Lord tempts no man. Yeah.
Okay. How do we reconcile that with this? Right?
Okay. James is talking about being tempted to sin.
Right.
So he's saying, let no man say that God tempted me to sin. And once again, the kind of questions that come up from this passage are manifold. There are lots of questions here. And the only answer I have is, he's God. And in his book, he decided to tell you this about himself. That he is so God, and in fact so sovereign, that he is willing to utilize lying spirits for the end result of his good.
Right.
Because he does sovereignly sit on his throne doing whatsoever seems good to him. Now to us, we would say, that's quite conniving, God. That's quite nefarious what you're doing here. He's God. Whatever he does is good by virtue of the fact that it is God doing it.
And he allows us every day sleep.
Pardon me?
This is nothing unique. He allows us every day.
Right.
This is how God works every day. And you might as well know that this is the God you're dealing with. Because this is very different from the God who is being preached far and wide, who they have put into this little box and narrowly defined him as good and only good according to what we consider goodness. And so therefore God can't do certain things when in fact God can do anything he wants.
And will.
It brings glory
and
to him.
Does. What brings glory to him? Exactly. God's primary motivation in everything he does is his holiness and what glorifies him. And what glorified him here was to make sure that all the lying prophets in Israel with one mouth told the king to go up to Ramoth-Gilead, and he had one guy, Micaiah, the only guy who's named by name, who told the truth on God, and the king is going to believe the 40 because in the Bible the majority is always wrong. He's going to believe the 40 and he's going to go up and die. We're going to get to that real quick here. But you have to come to grips with the fact that this God is in fact so sovereign that he controls the fate of people. And for the folks who don't like Calvinistic thinking and who want to say, well, God must choose and elect everybody and then you get yourself out from under that election, or however else they want to deal with the notion of God's absolute sovereign election, you have right here a king who has not only been predicted to die a horrible bloody death and the dogs are going to eat him and his wife and his whole family, his sons, everybody are going to be cut off, but then you have God sovereignly seeing to it by his own power and might that that exact thing is accomplished.
He's at the cross's fingers. Man,
I hope that works out. I put myself on the line here and said this was going to happen. Yeah, I hope he doesn't do something right. Let me put it another way. I had a surgery a couple of years ago. Most of you know about it. It was a terrible thing that I went through because I had this growth in my stomach. I came out of it glorifying God more than when I went into it. But in the middle of it, it was really terrible. Did God put the growth in me? Or did God utilize my sinful nature and the way Paul said a messenger of Satan sent to buffet me, did God utilize evil to bring greater glory and greater commitment in my life to him? God used something really terrible and awful and a sickness that could have killed me that caused a horrible event in a hospital so that I would come away all the more committed that the rest of my life I would be declaring the sovereignty of God. Good came from it, but it was a really bad thing that happened. Now, do I say to God, you're the one who put this in me? Well, no. Again, God doesn't tempt anybody, but he certainly can use the devil to bring sickness on people. He can certainly use devils to bring lies into people's mouths. But it's not God who does it. It's simply God who, like you said, allows it or commands it or decrees it, who adjusts it. God doesn't have to tempt anybody to sin. All he has to do is take his hand off you and let the devils tempt you, and your own natural nature will follow.
Right.
But is God sovereign enough to do that? Yeah, that's what the book of Job is all about. That he ended up saying, yes, you can do this, but not that. Yes, you can kill his kids, but you can't touch him. Yes, you can touch his flesh and bring the boils up on him, but you can't kill him. All the way down the line, he said to the devil, you can do this, but not that. You can do this, but not that. You can do this, but not that. It was the devil that brought all that bad stuff, but it was under God's decree and will.
Satan's just a pawn in his hands.
Satan is a pawn in his hands. And that's why people who give Satan equal power and credibility with God, God gets a vote, the devil gets a vote, now you cast the deciding vote. No. The devil is God's footstool, and the devil does exactly what God would have him do to bring glory to God. And when he's done with the devil, he will put him in the lake of fire with all his angels. The book of Revelation says he will. And he will be here as long as he serves God's purpose. And when God is done, he'll get rid of him. And he uses him here again. The upside of that is that means God is in control of devils, and no devil can get you and no lie can come your way unless God is directing it. And God loves you too much not to do that which is for your greatest good. And he's too holy not to do that which brings him the greatest glory. So it's good to know that he is so sovereign that he is sovereign over the good and the bad. You get all that? But you can't possibly create a free will theology out of that passage. Yes, you can put your hand up. What?
In 22, said the Spirit said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Why are you so convinced that this is an evil lying spirit? Why is it not possible that it's one of the Lord's that he just...
Because the same thing we were just talking about. While God himself doesn't tempt anybody, he uses evil spirits to do the tempting. To say that God uses good, pure, clean, elect angels to lie to people is far too confusing.
But they fell.
The fact that he said on right hand and left hand is very clearly a designation. Jesus used it several times to say the good and the bad, the good and the bad. So if the bad are gathered there at this meeting and one steps forward and says, I'll be a lying spirit, it's almost impossible not to say that it has to be somebody from the left side.
And you can look at Job because it's exactly what happened with Job.
Exactly what happened with Job.
Satan comes, he's like, what you been doing? Hey, you thought about a Job boy?
Yeah.
Oh, let me do this. Okay, you can do this, but not that.
Right.
You know, I find it interesting how when you read language like that, where it's like God's carrying on a conversation and he's asking questions. You know, I just wonder why, you know, he knew who was going to come forward. He knew, I mean, that language is there.
Right.
What are you doing? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? You know, and... Yeah.
Well, not because God wants to know.
It's
because he wants us to know.
Right.
Yeah, and he wants people to face what they're doing and what they're saying and what they're thinking. Yeah, the same way that I would walk into my children, you know, when they have their hand in the cookie jar and say, what are you doing? I know what they're doing. Yeah. Okay, let's finish this. We got to hurry. Verse 23. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets, and the Lord has spoken evil concerning thee. But Zedekiah, the son of Chena'anah, went near and smote. He's the one, remember, with the iron horns? He went and he struck Micaiah on the cheek, and he said, which way did the spirit of the Lord go when it left me and came to you? And Micaiah said, behold, you shall see in that day when thou shalt go into an inner chamber and hide yourself. And the king of Israel said, take Micaiah and carry him back to the governor of the city, unto Joash, the king's son, and say, thus says the king, put this fellow in prison, feed him with the bread of affliction and the water of affliction until I come back here in peace. And Micaiah said, if you return in peace, the Lord has not spoken to me. And he said, hearken, O people, every one of you. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go enter the battle. But you put on your robes and sit up on the hill. And the king of Israel disguised himself and went down into the battle. But the king of Syria commanded his 32 captains that rule over his chariot, saying, fight neither with small or great, but save only for the king of Israel. Try to find the king. That'll end the war. He's down there among all the people, disguised. It came to pass when the captain of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat that they said, surely that's the king of Israel. So they turned aside to go and fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out, and it came to pass that the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel, so they turned back from pursuing him. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture. In other words, a guy in the middle of the battle pulled an arrow back into a bow and just shot it up in the air, not even aiming at anything. And it smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness, between his shoulder blades. Wherefore he said to the driver of his chariot, turn your hand and carry me out of the host of the war here, because I'm wounded. And the battle increased that day, and the king was set up or stayed up in his chariot against the Syrians, and he died that evening. And the blood ran out of the wound into the chariot. And there went a proclamation throughout all the host about the going down of the sun, saying, every man go back to his city and every man to his own country. So the king died, and he was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria, and one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up the blood, and they washed his armor according to the word of the Lord which he had spoken, because God is that sovereign. Now, when I see you in 2 weeks, we'll pick up at Elisha making Jehu, who's going to be a good king, making Jehu the king of Israel. And it's going to be Jehu who is then, once King Ahab's dead, is going to kill off all of Ahab's sons. And everything that God said here is going to happen. And then Jezebel is going to make two mistakes. One is she's going to make up her face. The second is she's going to look out a window. And then she's going to get eaten by dogs. Exactly as God says. And you have to know that if God was this serious about putting a stop to this kind of evil and putting a stop to this kind of worship, and if God was this serious about idols, and if God would keep this Jezebel imagery alive all the way to the book of Revelation, he's trying to tell us something. I mean, do you realize that this stuff we're reading in 1 Kings, this is before the Assyrian captivity? This is before the Babylonian captivity. This is long before the Medo-Persians and the Greeks, long before Rome and Jesus. You're going a long way back here to a piece of history that could have sort of disappeared into the Old Testament. But Jesus in the book of Revelation picked it up again and wanted to remind his church that this kind of infiltration was just simply not to happen. And yet, as we just moments ago had no problem naming plenty of examples of idols and idol worship. Throughout the Old Testament, you'll find that God speaks of Israel as being an erring wife and says that she is a wife of whoredoms. And so this notion of spiritual whoredom is tantamount to the notion of chasing after foreign gods, which he said was like Israel, his wife, chasing after other lovers. And you've got to get that picture so that when we get into the book of Revelation again in 3 weeks, when we get back here, and we're going to come across a woman who is a woman of whoredoms, who's riding on a beast, drinking a cup full of abominations. She is that Jezebel image again that shows up. Because this imagery, though it seems like ancient Old Testament stuff, is actually very current and very future to us. Because one of the things that the Antichrist will do is make sure that Christianity is completely subverted by idol worship and by everything that will get your eyes off of the sufficiency of Christ and everything that can get between you and the worship in spirit and in truth of the true and genuine God. And there are lots and lots and lots of methods to do that. Many of them are already quite effective, but just imagine how effective they'll be once the church has been taken off the planet. The Holy Spirit effectively draws back and the world is left to worship God knows what. Especially then when Antichrist himself sets up an idol of himself in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God and requires everyone to bow down to the idol and take the mark. His false prophet, his religious leader, is going to cause everyone, great and small, free and bond, to take a mark in their right hand and their forehead that is called the mark of the beast. There will be the idol of the beast and the mark of the beast, and everybody who takes that mark, it says, ends up in the lake of fire, primarily because of their worship of an idol, of a worship of a thing that was not God and was not Christ, because that Jezebel doctrine will still be running rampant, alive and well. You see why this Jezebel thing is so important? And it always has been important with God. We're back here in 1 Kings, it's important to God. You get to Revelation, it's still important to God. So that's a clue. This ought to be something that you really take an inventory of your life with and say, how many things are there between me and God? And then make sure that you do some house cleaning and make sure that your worship of God is in spirit and in truth. You got all that? Okay, am I going to be here next week?
No.
Okay, remember that. I will be in Lexington next week, so I'll see you here in 2 weeks.